Hey there, this is Betsy Woodruff with National Review, and I'm here with Kate Nocera.
Hi, I'm Kate Nocera with BuzzFeed.
And we were both in South Carolina over the last, I guess, 3 to 5 days to cover the what we thought might have been the end of Mark Sanford's political career, but
And then it turned out to be
obviously,
a blowout. Yeah,
I
it's
know, I know, it's
crazy.
crazy. So I think the plan for today is just to chat a bit about how what went down in SC, and then kind of what that might mean going forward, and look at how what this suggests for other races and other political leaders. So I know Kate, when we were down there, we talked about how pretty much the day before people were expecting that Sanford would pull it off, but I know I was surprised that he won by 10. What was your take
I
on that?
was surprised too. I mean, the polls showed that the race was incredibly close for a really long time, right? And he was actually down 9 points 2 weeks before the race, according to PPP polls. And it was strange because when I got there on Saturday and was with him for most of the day, going from storefront to storefront, people were really taken with the guy, that he had a lot of support. There were people that kind of maybe rolled their eyes at him a little bit, but it didn't seem like we ran into too many people who were jazzed about his opponent, Elizabeth Colbert Bush. He is really just a good retail politician, I think.
I agree. I think you can't understate how important his ability to connect with voters is. And one thing that I chatted about with one reporter down there that I think maybe people haven't talked about as much as it merits is the fact that in special elections, people don't really come out to vote against politicians. I imagine there were a lot of people in South Carolina who thought Mark Sanford, that guy's a joke. It's so embarrassing. He might go back to Washington, but those people aren't going to come out to vote. People don't vote because they're depressed or because they're cynical.
And I
And
think what yeah, go ahead,
and
sorry.
I think that was one of the maybe one of the reasons that Colbert or was a contributing reason that Colbert Bush couldn't pull it off because she didn't
The
really.
other part about her was that, I mean, this was a problem for us when we were down there trying to cover it, is she wasn't anywhere, I mean, she would do a few events a day. She wasn't out there as much as he was, and when you're running for Congress, I mean, you have to go for 12 hours a day. He was running like an underdog, and she was running like she kind of had it, which was not the case. I mean, she was
Yeah, not
still,
at all.
people in Charleston know her, but she was still a relative unknown. I also think his name ID really helped him,
Yeah, I
even if
agree.
people didn't have the best feelings about him, they at least knew who he was,
Right, and he had a
which was
record to
different.
run on too, which I think was really big. And he could say, "I went to Congress. This is how I voted. I was fiscally conservative before being fiscally conservative was cool, if you will." And Colbert Bush really didn't have that. Hey, one thing that's interesting, I think, is you spent more time with Sanford than I did because I think you had an extra day down there. And on Sunday, we both followed Colbert Bush around for one of her canvassing events. And I was just struck by how different their approaches to canvassing were. Colbert Bush was in this really small neighborhood with this enormous bus that was kind of backing up traffic and full of people, and she had this publisher's clearinghouse style entourage going door to door with her. And when Sanford was canvassing, it would be just Sanford and his one assistant who's gave him a wide berth. And I thought I was kind of struck by how different that was.
That really struck me too. I mean, I think that Sanford was approachable. People would come up to him, people would talk to him. She was always surrounded by a giant entourage. It was different for folks to be able to approach her, and the opportunities to approach her weren't there as much.
I
What
agree.
really struck me about this, and you were there for this, Betsy, when she did a press conference with Congressman Jim Clyburn, and reporters who had descended on Charleston really wanted to know some of her policy positions. And what really struck me was that she didn't have a lot of great answers
Yeah,
when
for
we were
sure.
asking her
I was surprised
about
by that too.
about that.
I remember you and Chris Moody were pushing her a little bit to see what issues she'd differ from Democratic leadership on. And I think she might have given one of the worst answers I've heard in a press conference, which was,
right.
Chris was pressing her on if she would have voted to repeal Obamacare, and when she says, well, let's get to May 7th, and I'll get elected, and then we'll talk about it. What's the point of campaigning if you tell people to elect them and then you'll tell them what you're going to do? Like that was just very odd. I mean, I understand that you're running in a red district and you don't really want to, let your liberal flag fly, assuming that you have one. But, there's a point where questions like, will you vote to repeal Obamacare? You should probably have an answer to that. That's not a gotcha question.
I think her strategy really was to try and put all of the focus on Sanford and all of the focus on his negatives, but that enabled Sanford to kind of fill in the blanks for voters about her. When she wasn't going to answer any questions about how she would vote with Democratic leadership, whether or not she would repeal Obamacare, it became really easy for him to say, well, she can't answer this, so she's getting tons of money from national Democrats, so obviously she's going to vote with them. When she couldn't give a good rebuttal to that, I think that was really when we all saw that this race was not going to be as close as everyone said it was going to be.
I agree. I think that's totally true.
Totally.
I think there are also some interesting parallels between the way Colbert Bush ran against Sanford and the way a lot of Republicans ran in 2012, and that both of them basically ran campaigns of don't vote for the other guy. For Republicans, often, the one talking point that you heard over and over, just iterated and reiterated and re-reiterated, was, hey, Democrats are doing a bad job, don't vote for them, they're not that great.
Right.
And, Colbert Bush kind of had the same thing, which was, guys, did you know Sanford went to Argentina? Guys, you cheated on his wife.
And he used taxpayer money to go there.
He robbed the people.
Right, exactly.
And that's not a successful get out the vote strategy. It just doesn't work. People don't get excited about democracy if the message that they hear is your elected leaders are failing you.
I think that it's been, it was interesting, because it is such a red district, and I know that I paid pretty close attention to some Democratic congressmen who run in red districts. There aren't that many of them left, but take Jim Matheson, for instance, in Utah. He represents one of the most conservative districts. I think he represents the most conservative district held by a Democrat. Mm-hmm. And everyone thought he was toast. He had a really compelling opponent in Mia Love, who was a Black Mormon conservative mayor. And it was a district that Romney won by many points, and he pulled it out. But he pulled it out because he is a campaigner like Sanford was, people know him. He's a known quantity. People like him. It wasn't, I think that is how Democrats win districts like that is you have to put yourself out there and let people know you and let people know where you stand as opposed to just running against Republicans, running against Democrats.
I think maybe the moral of the story is if you don't prevent a compelling alternative to the status quo, you're probably not going to do a good or great job on election.
Right. Exactly.
Because people don't vote against politicians. People vote for politicians. And at the end of the day, that's what gets them to come out. That's interesting about Matheson. I hadn't heard that he's such an effective or dumb politician.
He really is. I mean, if you look at the numbers, if you just look at the sheer, he's like on the top of the NRCC's, to get list every single year. And every single year he's won. You know, even in 2010 when there was that huge anti-incumbency wave, he's just a very, very good politician. And I think people underestimated that about Mark Sanford, too.
I think that's sort of true. Something that's interesting about retail politics is I think especially in the Twitter era, the era of Organizing for America, when so much of how political campaigns are run is digitized, and there's such an emphasis on emails and Facebook campaigns and Twitter campaigns, I was surprised by how important the one-on-one contact seemed. And maybe we're overestimating the significance of the number of hands that Mark Sanford shook, but I mean,
it was a lot of hands.
It was a lot of hands, yeah. And I think perhaps when people are are increasingly acclimatized to only interacting with their political leaders, you know, through a screen or through mm-hmm. tweets or, you know, via social media. I think that actually meeting people in person can be even more important than it was maybe in the year before social media, just because it's such a contrast. I think if you're only
Absolutely.
Used to, yeah, I think if you think of these politicians as living on the internet, meeting them in real life might be even more impactful and memorable than it has been.
Absolutely. I mean, you can't overstate how many people he talked to. I know that it was exhausting for us just following him around. I can't imagine.
I know.
Having yeah. done it for all those many months. And so
oh, yeah.
now he's coming
following
to Congress.
Him for one day was tiring. I was like, jeez,
really
I'm
tiring.
Such a martyr. I follow this guy for a day. And he's been
I
doing
know.
This every day. Like, that's crazy.
I know. How many stores did we go to? Like, you know, we went to tire stores and grocery stores and it was
shops
really
shops and
to
pizza
watch.
Stores. I think we went to like at least 2 FedEx stores in one day.
Yep.
I
don't know. There was such a big Stanford vote in the FedEx store, but you know, there would be like 2 people in each of these places, and he would sit there and he would talk to them, and it was always
yeah.
2 people, which was different than what she was doing, which was phone banking, you know, out of an office somewhere trying to contact 200 people. But you know, I don't think we can. I think we have to give him a lot of credit for that face to face work that he did.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. So
and so now he's gonna come here next week. He's being sworn in next week.
Yeah.
I don't know what you you know. I think it's gonna be really interesting to watch to see his relationship with leadership after the NRCC decided not to back him. I mean, he really doesn't owe anyone anything once he gets here.
I know. It's interesting is probably a good word to use there.
Yeah,
Mr. Stanford comes to Washington. I guess
I know.
And you know, this has been mentioned by everyone, but it's fascinating that he doesn't owe anyone anything.
Right.
I mean, you know, NRCC obviously didn't do him any favors, and I don't think he's going to feel like he needs to return that. I mean, he voted the way Ron Paul voted very often during his congressional career, and I wouldn't be surprised if we see that continue. One thing that I
saw a
tweet.
Sorry,
oh, go ahead.
Ahead.
Yeah.
No, I saw a tweet that that NRCC chairman Greg Walden had called him to congratulate him, and it went straight to voicemail, and I think people read into that, but we also forget that Stanford gave out his cell phone number to literally everyone, and
yeah.
And he told me on the trail that he keeps it off most times now. So we'll see if he gets a new phone number once he gets to Washington.
We'll see or we won't see.
Yeah,
as it were. That's funny. I didn't
right.
know that.
I don't think he's giving it to me.
Yeah, geez. No, it's going to be interesting. I think another interesting thing to keep an eye on will be if his tone changes this time in Congress versus last time. You know, partly because he's
mm-hmm.
older, he's had experience as governor, but also because this is something he talked about in his victory speech, having been through the ostracization and then redemption process. Sometimes
right,
that might
right.
take you down a notch or two, to use a pejorative term.
If he'll tone it down or what.
Right,
I mean, but
right.
it'll also be interesting to see how much, you know, I don't know if you read the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee statement, Chairman Israel's statement when Stanford won, but, you know, they say he's the new face of the Republican Party in their attempts to tie him to other Republican candidates, if that's going to be effective at all. I don't know what you think about that.
I don't think so.
Mm-hmm.
Partly because I don't think it's true. I mean,
mm-hmm.
if there's been a narrative from the GOP in Washington, it's that they're, you know, they're not throwing a big welcome party for Stanford. This is
right.
It's not like Aiken's case where the NRCC or NRSC, you know, gave him money at the last second. Washington Republicans' hands are very clean of the Stanford career resurrection. So,
right.
I mean, you know, good luck to Democrats, but I don't think it's going to be that effective of a tool. I think it's a fun thing to trot around, but I think it's also very difficult to dump on Mark Stanford without sounding a little bit smug.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I just don't see that being very successful. I mean, also, like, I think there's some interesting parallels between now, I guess, Congressman-elect Stanford and President Clinton, as far as people mm-hmm. who made comebacks from potentially career-ending sex scandals. And I think an important similarity here, and something that maybe people haven't talked about, is the fact that both of them are just fantastic career politicians. Not career, retail politicians. I mean, you know, the one thing you hear about Clinton is that you meet him and you like it. A likable guy. Right. And I think Sanford pretty much fits that to a T. So,
I know that Slate's Dave Weigel tweeted when Sanford won, you know, somewhere Anthony Weiner's sitting there smiling as he attempts to make his comeback. The situations were obviously a little bit different, but we'll see.
I think the Weiner comparison is a really interesting one. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I can't really speak to it because I don't know a lot about. I've never met Weiner or interacted with him in person. I don't know a lot about his ability to sort of do the charm offensive. And I'm also not sure he's spent enough time in exile. You know, Sanford was off the map for a while. And Weiner, it's been, 2 years maybe? So maybe that's enough time.
Something like that. Yeah.
I don't know.
Sanford really went off the grid. But I was even talking to some Republican consultants in South Carolina who were saying they didn't think that Sanford had given enough time. I mean, they're happy he won now, but they had felt like, you know, you write a book, you become very active in church, you do all the things that you need to do to, you know, you publicly go on a book tour before you do this. But you saw that Sanford doesn't really listen to people.
Yeah, not really.
He just kind of does his own thing. So,
yeah.
And it worked out for him.
Yeah, no, it's true. And another thing that's interesting, as we're sort of, you know, poo-pooing the chances, or at least I'm poo-pooing the chances of a Weiner return, is that he's still married to his wife.
Yes.
And I think, and, you know, Sanford's engaged to, you know, the Argentinian woman, Maria Belen Chapur.
Yeah.
So, mm-hmm. I mean, it's, you know, there's not a statistically significant set of politicians who've had sex scandals that I think we can really come out with a model for how
not,
to
it's
survive.
It's not a good science, right?
Yeah, right.
Not an exact science, right?
It's yeah, exactly. It's not an exact science, but there will be lots of fodder for conversations about what the formula for recovery is, and you know, according to Sanford, staying married, fixing your marriage is not necessarily part of that formula. I think that's a big change. So.
Wow. He'll be fun to cover up here on the Hill at the very least.
It's going to be so fun.
So.
this entire race was just a political reporter's dream come true.
It kind of was, yeah. Exactly.
If Elizabeth Colbert Bush had been a little more eccentric, but let's not look a gift horse in the mouth. It was pretty great.
I think it became a really weird weekend when he drove my car. That was weird. That's never happened to me before.
Note to car rental organizations.
Right. I'm not saying which one it was. I hope that they don't watch this. but also, you know, he was just very, very open with reporters and very willing to talk about really anything.
It's true, yeah. It's true, and I mean that's sort of the beauty of Sanford's non-entourage. You know, right. As you mentioned, the fact that he just hopped into Chris Moody's car, he just hopped into your car. I drove him around for a little bit, and it wasn't even weird. I mean, and you contrast that with the fact that Colbert Bush is sort of swathed in this enormous Elizabeth Means Business charter bus. You want to talk about sort of a visual indicator of how differently these campaigns were run? I think the charter bus might be the image that we fell back on. Dave Weigel and I talked to Sanford for a bit and actually he drove us around one morning. He was like, "Hey, there's this neighborhood I want you to see. Let me drive you to this neighborhood. I think you'll get a kick out of it."
That,
and
I'm
like,
yeah.
"Oh, okay, cool." and I asked him if he was jealous of Elizabeth Colbert Bush's bus. You know, if that was something that he'd, if he had bus envy, and he just kind of looks at me and goes, no.
No.
Not in so many words.
No, no.
But,
it was a tough thing to drive around small neighborhoods, too.
Yeah,
but,
I know.
So, So, I mean, I don't, you know, I think a lot of people were wondering, you know, what does this race mean for anything? I don't know if you have any takeaways. I don't think it means much.
I agree. I agree.
That a heavily Republican district went Republican. So, that
I agree.
Was my...
Yeah. It's a heavily Republican district and a Republican one. If it means anything, it means that Republicans will often win in Republican districts. Surprise.
I do have to say that she did do, we do have to give her some credit because, you know, Romney won that district by like 18 points and yeah, Sanford won by 10, but
that's
it was still,
point.
You know, she did close the, you know, his negatives are still there. There are still people that definitely don't like him and don't want to vote for him.
It's true. And, you know, and she ran a compelling enough campaign that to the day before people were thinking she could win, you know?
Right.
I mean,
right.
I wrote my day before piece and framed it as, I think I might have just watched Sanford do his last day of campaigning.
Right.
And I don't think I was the only reporter to approach it that way. Because, you know, she's a solid candidate.
She was.
And I think the important thing to remember about Clover Bush is that she didn't say anything that got herself in trouble.
Right, and she did incredibly well at the debate. I don't know if you watched the debate, but for someone who's never debated or been a politician before, I mean, she didn't, there was no major gaffe, she didn't lose any ground, and she did hit him a few times where it hurts, you know, so she was, she was, you have to give her credit for not having any major stumbles, but the numbers were just...
That's true. That's true. I think we can say it's a solid rookie effort. And I think maybe the lesson for this for Democrats is that if you're running in a red district and you have a chance of winning, it's not worth it to play it safe.
Right.
I think perhaps if Clover Bush had taken more risks, if she'd done more debates, if she put herself out there a little bit more, maybe ditched the entourage. I don't know if that would have changed the outcome of the race, but it might have made for a longer Tuesday night.
Right. I mean, I do think that, you know, we need to the moderate Democrat is like kind of becoming a unicorn in some ways. There's not a lot of space for them. You know, we've seen a number of retirements recently in the Senate. A huge number of them retired last year, and so I don't know if moderation plays well anymore. I don't know if you have any thoughts on that.
No, I think that's a good point. Yeah. Yeah, I think a lot of noise has been made, and fairly so, about the endangered status of the moderate Republican, especially given that the House is more conservative now than it was 10 years ago. That's a big deal.
Right.
But I think you're right that we have to bear in mind that moderate Democrats are kind of in similarly jeopardized positions. I mean, look at Heidi Heitkamp. Squeaked out her Senate victory, which, you know, it was a big deal that she won that seat. And you'd think that Washington Democrats would just be, you know, throwing confetti at her all day long. And then she, you know, voted against the Manchin-Toomey background check bill. Was not the deciding vote. It would have gone down whether she'd voted for or against it. And you see, you know, Washington Post op-eds of, you know, former Obama people asking for their money back. And you see her, you know, just getting shamed in all the ads. And it's just like, geez, guys, you know, Heidi Heitkamp's your gal. It's not like there's going to be a more liberal Democrat who's going to win in North Dakota. The only Democrat who can win in North Dakota is Heidi Heitkamp. You know, she's it. She's all you got.
And again, it goes back to that thing about a really good politician. I mean, I think she ran, I think she's a super compelling candidate. She ran a good race. She was out there all the time, talking to people. And, you know, she would argue she's voting for her state and she didn't, you know, come to Washington to vote with Democrats. And that is how you win. I think the thought was, though, you know, you just got here. You have another 6 years to vote conservatively. Why are you doing this to us now? But, you know, you have to give her some credit for voting how she said she was going to.
Yeah, absolutely. the whole keeping your campaign promises thing.
Right. I mean, there was an interview with her in Politico a little while ago, you know, where she said, yeah, her office was flooded with calls, but overwhelmingly it was people from North Dakota calling to say, please vote against this. And so I think that that's what, a lot of folks didn't really understand, is that there was a push with these moderate Democrats like Baucus, like Heitkamp, with people calling in from their state to say, you know, please don't do this.
Yeah, for sure. And I think there's an interesting contrast to be drawn between Heidi Heitkamp and Elizabeth Gilbert Bush as far as moderate Democrats running in very red, you know, districts and states. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, people are probably going to be able to nitpick the Elizabeth Gilbert Bush campaign until Kingdom Come. It's not like it wasn't a disaster, but, you know, obviously there were some things that did wrong. And Heitkamp, on the other hand, I mean, you have some people saying she ran the best race of 2012. You know, it was risky. It was very North Dakota centric. She very much, I think, channeled the culture of her state, and you pulled it off by the skin of her teeth. So
yeah,
I think I think maybe that's kind of an interesting thing to talk about in terms of how to be a successful moderate Democrat, and maybe a lot of it has to do with just ingraining yourself in the culture of the region, state, district that you want to represent.
I think that we saw that with Tester last cycle as well in Montana. Yep. You know, that was not a state that was going to go to Obama, but Tester is so Montana centric. I mean, he looks like he's from Montana.
I know. He has a farm and everything.
He literally brings meat from Montana to DC.
No.
Because he doesn't. Yeah, he does.
I didn't know that.
In like a freezer on the plane.
That's a lie.
You can read it in the New York Times. It's amazing.
Wow.
And he, you have to understand that, you know, people there who feel like they know him feel like he's one of us. He's one of us guys. And I think Reberg, got caught up in Washington a lot, and that was also part of why he lost. You know, Baucus is he'll say Montana every other word, especially, you know, before he said he was retiring. But you know, he's the chairman of the finance committee. All of his staff go off to be tax lobbyists. I think it was going to be a little bit harder for him to distance himself from DC.
I agree. So, I think that's true. And speaking of Montana, as long as we're talking about a red state where Democrats do surprisingly well, their former governor, Brian Schweikert, who basically will be the Democratic nominee for Baucus' seat if he wants it, is simultaneously extremely Montana, but also, I don't know if I'd call him moderate, because on some things he's very far to the left, you know, like pushing for for single payer healthcare, like Canadian style healthcare. But at the same time, you know, very pro energy. He postures himself as very pro coal, pro natural gas development,
pro gun. I think he's more conservative on guns than Baucus is. So it's been a little confusing for me to watch some of the progressive groups say they really support him when I think that we don't really know as much about his gun stance, but the sense that I get is that he's a very very conservative on guns.
Yeah, I think I might have read somewhere that he suggested he would have supported Manchin to me, but I'm not sure if that bears out. I could be wrong about that, but
the interesting thing about
his rhetoric on guns is extremely conservative. He's as conservative as a Republican when he talks about guns. I think his quote is, someone asked him how many guns he has, and he said, more than I need and less than I want, something like that.
Right. Yeah. But it's interesting with the healthcare stuff. You brought up the healthcare stuff. He wants single payer healthcare, but he wants single payer healthcare for Montana. So he frames it in this very Montana way. He says, you know, we don't have a lot of people here. It would be less expensive. It would, you know, he doesn't like Obamacare because he doesn't feel like, you know, there's that option as much, and he would like his state to be able to do that, like, right away, like Vermont's doing. You know, I think states with low populations, he's arguing it would be less expensive to run a single payer. So it's smart of him to at least play it in that way, that it's, you know, the best option for Montana rather than...
That's a good point. That's a really good point. Yeah. That it all comes back to this state identity, and that, and that it seems like it's not ideological, but it's more pragmatic.
Right.
I think that's probably something that that moderates running in districts that are the opposite color of them really have to bear in mind. So maybe that's the formula. Maybe the formula is identify with your district as much as possible, and and don't be an ideologue.
It seems so obvious, you know, but I think that those of us that write about this stuff, and we just look at numbers and polls, and then there's such a difference going there and seeing the vibe on the ground. I know I was really struck by the difference between, you know, what I was reading about in D.C. and what I was actually, you know, seeing and feeling in the district.
Oh, yeah, me too, 100%.
So, yeah. Speaking of Obamacare, they're going to vote to repeal it next week again in the House, and I wanted to know, you know, your take on that, if you think that that's a smart idea for House Republicans to start that again.
You know, I don't think it's going to hurt them. I don't think there's any House Republican who's going to get in trouble at home for voting to repeal Obamacare for the nth time.
Right.
I doubt it's going to get Obamacare repealed. I don't know if the Senate's going to vote on it.
I really doubt that Harry Reid's bringing that one up. Yeah.
But, I mean, you know, if they've got time to kill and they want to burnish their conservative bona fides a little bit more, go for it, you know?
Right.
Democracy.
Right. And I think the conservative, the super conservative wing of the caucus, every Republican is going to vote to repeal it, but has really been pushing to try and show again that they're trying to repeal it. But I just don't know. It's the 37th time. We get it, I guess.
Oh, right. I know. And I think it's possible that House Republicans are flirting with falling into this, maybe Elizabeth Colbert Bush syndrome, if you will, of primarily defining themselves in terms of what they're against and what they're not, rather than what they're for. I think that's the safe route to take, especially when you've got poll numbers on Obamacare, and when, you know, it's not a political risk. You know, no one's going to lose their seat or get primaried because they vote to repeal Obamacare. Right. But I think as far as efficient uses of time, as far as rebranding, you know, which we've been talking about a lot over the last couple of months, I think maybe having the same vote 37, 38 times is not necessarily the smartest way to do that.
But it's also, it does give, I mean, the flip side, it does give conservative Democrats, I mean, like Matheson and McIntyre and the ones that are still left in the House, an opportunity to prove that they can buck their party leadership, that they're not, you know, it's a meaningless vote in the long run. The law is not going to be repealed, so they can vote against it and use that in their campaigns, too.
Good point.
You know, so it's a benefit for those Democrats as well.
So circling back to Sanford, something I wanted to run by you, and I'm just curious what your take on this is I think from having conversations with people on the ground that we talked to, and then looking at some of the post-game analysis at different national news sites, from what I can gather, there are basically four reasons that Sanford won. And I think each of these is necessary, but not necessarily sufficient in and of itself. So the four reasons I would think are the fact that it's a really red district. That's a no-brainer. Right. The fact that Sanford had a record to run on. His name ID was a mixed blessing, but he could say, look, I went to Washington, this is how I voted. I was governor, this is how I governed. So he had a record. Right. He was a known quantity, is the term that's been thrown around.
Right.
I think the third thing, and this is something that we discussed really extensively, is the fact that he's a really great retail politician. We can't underestimate the influence of shaking hundreds and hundreds of hams for a couple months. I think it's easy to underestimate that when you don't go to South Carolina, and that's something that I wouldn't have gotten if I hadn't gone down there. But I think being on the ground, it's something else. And then I think the fourth thing, and this is something that we haven't talked about yet, is that his campaign did a really great job with earned media. We talked a lot about the Nancy Pelosi cutout debate, and what you hear from South Carolina Republicans is that that was the turning point. I don't know if that's true. I don't know if that passes the smell test. But
I don't know if it was the turning point, but it certainly made a statement that right. I don't think that they had really clearly made yet at that point. You know, it was really silly for him to be debating.
Goofy. You know,
it was goofy, but they hadn't made that point yet, you know, which was, and that's how they did turn things around, was making that point. Like, do you want someone who's going to go and, you know, beef up the Democratic numbers?
Right. Do you want somebody to go with Pelosi?
And what they needed to do. Nancy Pelosi is not it's almost a dirty word in that district.
And that's true, yeah.
At least that's what I found. And so by tying Colbert Bush to her, I think that was a pretty effective move on their part.
Absolutely. I think the campaign and South Carolina Republicans deserve a lot of credit for nationalizing the race. Mm-hmm. Because for all practical purposes, this is not a race that has huge national implications. There's nothing that's going to get passed or not going to get passed because Sanford won. I mean, it's helpful for Republicans. It doesn't hurt them. It would have been helpful for Democrats. But the soul of our country was not in the balance on Tuesday night. But the Republicans managed to message in a way, I think, that made it seem like this was a race that wasn't just about the district. That was something we heard all the time. This race isn't just about our district. It's not just about South Carolina. It's about the direction our nation is moving. And I think that that's something that was a really effective message. And especially given that the Sanford campaign was so outspent, their ability to pull off these stunts and to bring up Pelosi and to get reporters to cover them in a way that wasn't necessarily flattering, but got them covered and wasn't about Argentina or the Appalachian Trail. That's not an easy feat to do. I'm hesitant to say that was a game changer, but that might have been the difference between 7 or 10 point win.
I think they ran an incredibly effective campaign, and I also think their ability to let their boss be their boss. Mm-hmm. was important as well. They understood that they couldn't control certain things and that everyone was going to write in every single story, you know, former governor with infamous past who was caught cheating and, you know, spent taxpayer dollars going to Argentina. They knew that was going to be in every single story that anyone wrote. Right. And so instead of, you know, running away or trying to distract from that, they kind of let him talk about it. You know, they let him air it out. And then, and then it was very easy for him to pivot and say, you know, what about her? Let's, you know, talk about, I think one of the weirdest moments for me on the trail with him, I was with Allie Weinberg from NBC News. And on Saturday, and we were talking to him, and she was asking about this trespassing incident where Jenny Sanford accused Mark of trespassing on the property about 2 weeks out from, you know, the news broke about 2 weeks before the election. Allie was asking, you know, do you think this is going to hurt you with women voters? And Sanford said, you know, that's a narrative you want to write. Let's go find a woman that hates me this way. he kind of dared us. So we literally went store to store, and Sanford was actively trying to find a woman that did not, in fact, like him. And it was very bizarre, but he totally made his point. And we found one woman. And he explained what was going on. I'm trying to find, you know, a woman that doesn't like me for these ladies in the national media. And she gives him such a huge side eye and says, you know, I don't like any, I totally disapprove of your personal life. I disapprove of what you did. But I'm, I'm conservative and that's it. And I'm, you know, I'm voting for you. And so, and I think that that was something we also heard again and again was he did what he did and that's that. And, but you know, I'm not a Democrat.
Right.
So,
right.
Yeah. Anyway. All right. Betsy, I gotta run to votes, in the House now. It was good talking to you.
Yeah, it's great talking to you, too.
All right.
Yeah, have a great rest of your day. And to the Bloggy Heads audience, thanks for listening.
Thanks for tuning in to us. Thanks.
All right, bye.